sorry about the wrong title. Extra delays. So I'm not Canadian, so I can't actually carry this thing. So is there a cricket bat? Right, I'm going to talk a little bit about dark matter, and basically I'm going to talk about what looks like a perhaps unusual signature, but in a class of models that I don't think is particularly exotic. You may or may not disagree. So this is work with Maxim. So just to set the scene, I'm not going to talk about motivations too much because, in fact, it's difficult. But we've heard already a number of talks about the cosmological motivations for dark matter. They range over many different scales. The problem, of course, from the point of view of particle physics is that it tells us nothing about their non-gravitational interactions. So you might think, what can you do in a model-independent way? Well, simple answer is not much. In the future, it may be possible to get something by looking at galaxy formation. There is an interplay between dark matter and baryons. Of course, there's this famous picture, now famous picture of the Bullitt cluster, which seems to tell us something about the lack of interactions between normal matter and dark matter. But at the moment, we are stuck. We have to make some kind of, we'll have to use some kind of theoretical prejudice. So the question, well, starting point is, what's the minimal amount of theoretical prejudice you can use? This is a quick plan of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to mention what I think that minimal amount of theoretical prejudice is. This is just to do with assuming that the dark matter candidate is a thermal relic. And then I'm going to mention some, perhaps, hints, perhaps they're not good hints, about why there are some little subtleties with that paradigm and how it just pushes you to consider an interesting region of parameter space. I'm going to talk about two aspects of that. I'm mainly going to focus on issues of direct detection, and then I'll mention briefly some issues to do with indirect detection as well. So this is what I think is the minimal amount of theoretical prejudice one can introduce here. This is just the paradigm. So the assumption is that you had particles which could annihilate in the early universe, and then at some point, because of the expansion, they freeze out. Very simple estimate here for the freeze-out abundance determined by the Einstein cross-section. We saw this already in Goichi's talk. It's exactly the same formula. You need a cross-section or a rate here, which is about peak of our scale. This is written in slightly non-relativistic units, but it's the same number. We now know this number, relative density very well, or at least within concordant cosmology, we know it very well. And it just so happens that if you take a particle with a weak scale mass and a weak scale annihilation cross section, everything seems to fit very nicely. So this is the very simple picture that people have used. Of course, it doesn't have to be that way. This is not the way we get the relative abundance of baryons. That's a completely different system because we have baryon number as a conserved approximate and conserved quantity. But nonetheless, it seems to be the simplest thing you can do. However, in most of what I think of as sort of standard models of new physics, that's not really how things work. So this is one of these very standard SUSY plots due to Keith Olive and co. This is a picture of some mass parameters for a minimal version of supersymmetry. And this is supposed to show some exclusion regions. Don't worry about too much about all these different regions, but if I want to look at a region where the relic density is allowed, I have to look at this thin blue line here. Basically, everywhere else, or actually everywhere above that line, produces too much dark matter. The relic density is too high, basically because the states are too heavy. Very simple-minded way. Go back. Here we go. If the mass gets too large here, the cross-section drops. And so if you want to live in a region where you're allowed to live, these are exclusion bounds on Higgs mass, the Chahimo mass, and various searches. This is not a new plot, but similar thing. You could write down similar things. Now, you want to be out here where the masses are relatively large. And in fact, if I just use that previous calculation for a simple freeze-out, nothing would be allowed. The only allowed region is down here. It's already excluded. So the only reason it works is because you have other particles in the problem, and you can actually enhance the annihilation cross-section through things like co-annihilation. So in this case, we have our Wimp state, but there's also a nearly degenerate charged slepton, Sau. And if the splitting is small enough, roughly of order, say 5 GeV for a few hundred GeV, and this works, and you can make the mass much larger, so you get this so-called W mass spread. So that's just maybe one hint. It's not necessarily a good motivation, but that's the one I'm going to use. And what I want to do is consider an extreme limit of this tuning. If I just think about a splitting like this, nothing much really changes. But if you have a small splitting, it's always interesting to ask what happens if you make it really, really small. So that's what we're going to do. So I'm going to assume this splitting is very, very small, order a few MeV, maybe up to around 20 MeV. So we're going to have a Wimp state and some other state which is going to be electrically charged. What I really need is something which is more strongly interacting than the Wimp itself. In this case, we'll just assume it has an electric charge. The splitting is going to be very small. This is perfectly okay for co-annihilation. But it's also small enough that you can get interesting interactions with the nuclei. So I'm just going to see what happens in this case. As I said, I'm not going to try and motivate it too much. Very naively, if you assume these things are part of some hidden sector where everything's degenerate, the charge state will be split just by the fact that it's charged. So it gets some electromagnetic contribution to its mass. And very naively, this would be of order 100 MeV. I want to make it a bit smaller than that, but not dramatically smaller. So this sort of picture was also considered by Stringer and Coe a while ago. So just to parameterize things, I don't have to say too much about what model we're looking at. But let's consider two cases. Either if I form some off-diagonal current with these two guys, it can either be a weak charge current or, say, a leptonic current. In this case, the interaction with the electrons is the relevant part. So if you want to have a SUSY model in mind, this would be a scenario where this is a neutralino and this is a chargeino. The second case is perhaps a more familiar one, where you have a neutralino and a charge slept on. And I just want to ask, what are the direct and indirect signatures for this? Given that it is part of the parameter space of fairly standard models.
Sorry?
Yeah?
If you have that small mass breath, you need a very heavy mass for to reach that threshold. Because the co-annihilation essentially determines the radical.
Yeah, but it doesn't really depend on the mass splitting, right? Once you get...
The mass should be higher than the normal.
Not really. I mean, it doesn't depend dramatically on the splitting, right? Once you get below 5 GeV, it doesn't change.
What creation means is that... that subpoint terminates.
Right? But that's right.
This is exactly that.
Yeah, it depends whether you want to have, if you want to have complete coverage of dark matter, then you have to be away from this little region.
No, I mean, the small mass difference means actually that white region below that blue region, that means a smaller abundance.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. If you can live here, right, because you just have a lower abundance than the...
Or you can add additional.
I mean, I don't want to push this CMSSM model too much, but absolutely, within this model, yeah, I'm thinking about this region out here.
That's right.
Yeah, that's a good point. But, you know, this is one particular model. I don't want to push it too much. All right, so if we're in this range, the point is you can actually form Coulomb bound states for nuclei. So this is a very simple quantum mechanical calculation of what the binding energy would look like. These are just a reasonable selection of different nuclei. Some of them are very light. We'll see why that's relevant later on. And some of them are relevant for direct detection experiments. We use two different charge profiles. A Gaussian profile is better for lighter. Nuclei, obviously, as the nuclei get heavier and heavier, the profile tends to become more like a step function. So, if you like, the real answer lies somewhere in between the step function and the Gaussian profile. But the point is, the binding energies here range up to around 20 MeV. It's just Coulomb binding, there's no strong interaction physics. So, you can think about for the purposes of this talk, two different ranges, binding energy up to around 4 MeV for lightish elements up to oxygen. And then the most interesting range actually for us would be between 4 MeV and 20 MeV, which is the heavy range. We'll see for various reasons this region is not always possible. And we haven't found a way to exclude this possibility. If the mass difference is too large for recombination, you can still get resonant enhancements. I'm not going to talk about that too much.
Why does it care about delta m?
Sorry?
Why does the binding care about delta m?
Well, this is, I should have said, this is in the limit where the dark matter set is much, much heavier. So the binding energy doesn't care about delta m, but what I'm going to worry about is an interaction where if I have some guy coming in, can it form a bound state? So if delta m then is less than the binding energy, then I have some energy difference and I can actually form the bound state. Or if delta m is too large, then I can't put it. For this calculation, it doesn't matter. I should have just mentioned that this is in the limit where we're treating the dark matter state as much heavier than the
PPP. Really makes it stable.
Sorry?
If delta m is smaller than the binding energy, then it is a stable part.
That's right. Yes.
What's the difference of this to the Sommerfeld effect?
Well, that's a Coulomb enhancement, so that's a resonant effect.
Yeah.
This is purely forming a bound state. So it's a stable bound state, it's not metastable. You could think of the resonant transition as being a metastable state.
There's a kind of a continuum, of course. As you go to this region here, where you obviously can't form a bound state, then the effects you are at this sort of Coulomb result. Okay, so this is the picture I have in mind. We imagine that the splitting between these two states is small enough that in interactions with nuclei, you can form bound states. So let's just go and have a think about what would happen in direct detection. This is just the standard, most recent plot from CDNS. The bounds here are cross-sections, spin-dependent cross-sections the per-nuclei cross-section is around the picobar, so it's actually much, much higher. Sometimes it's useful to think about it that way. And of course, what people are looking for is a purely elastic scattering, a recoil of the nucleus due to it being hit by some WIMPs. And the recoil energies are very small because the kinetic energy of the WIMPs relative to Earth is between 10 and 100 keV. So this is a very small energy scale relative to the binding energies I've just been talking about. So in this case, things could look a little bit different. This is a little cartoon. I talked about two different classes of models. This is the class which has a weak current. So this WIMP can come in, it can hit a nucleon. If delta M is sufficiently small relative to the binding energy, you have a transition like this and you form a bound state. Now, in that case, things are more complicated because you've changed the effective atomic number here, so this may or may not be allowed depending on the actual nuclear binding energy, the state we set plus one. So there's an issue there about whether that's allowed based on nuclear physics. In the other case, this is with electronic current, that issue doesn't arise. And to form a bound state, though, you have to kick out a positron, get the charge right, but ultimately in both cases you form something which should be absolutely stable. And the question is, what would you see in a detector? We're having in mind here that the cross-section for this process could in fact be much larger than the cross-section for an all-elastic scatterer. So in either case, the energy released here is going to be very large. In fact, we're talking about 20 MeV binding energy, so you should think of some reasonable range, several MeV energy released. I want to talk about these two in a bit more detail. So let's first look at this weak current capture. In general, it's a rather complicated problem, so we don't know exactly what kind of bound state will be formed. The assumption here is that it's produced in some kind of excited state, and then it has to shake itself down for a while, pick off some gammas, maybe neutrons, and so on. And to calculate it exactly would be rather difficult. The estimate we made is that the entrance width here is presumably much smaller than the decay width, because that's probably electromagnetic or strong, and so you just have a usual resonant expression for the cross-section. If you go through the motions of working out the rates, you find something which is actually not much larger than the normal elastic scattering rate. As I said, this is the rate per nucleus, not per nucleon, so it's enhanced by a factor of 8 to the 4th. So this is interesting, but not huge. The second case turns out perhaps to be even more interesting. So this is electromagnetic capture kicking out a positron. And in this case,
I'm just estimating it from looking at the standard approach, I guess, having the overlap with the scattering and bound state wave functions. It's a little more complicated because this positron, of course, has to tunnel out of a nuclear barrier, so there's a gamma suppression factor. That's not too bad because for generic energies, this positron is relativistic, so we don't get a huge suppression. But again, go through the motions. We can end up with a number now, and this is cross-section per nucleon. And so depending on the coupling here, this thing can be very large. So this is around 4 orders of magnitude larger for weak scale coupling than the current CMS bound. So in principle, it looks like you would have sensitivity processes like that for a reasonable value of this coupling. So this is kind of interesting. You might be thinking, well, is this actually viable? Is it ruled out by some kind of tests? The natural thing to think about are searches for heavy isotopes, rare isotopes. And what we found kind of interesting is that it doesn't actually seem to be ruled out. First of all, if I want to produce that positron, I need delta M to be larger than half an MeV. So in that case, there's no binding to hydrogen or helium. The strongest constraints on rare isotopes are for heavy water, basically for weird isotopes of hydrogen. So all those constraints go out the window. The best constraints after that are actually on anomalous isotopes of carbon. So that would be binding, say, with nitrogen in the atmosphere. And that's a non-trivial constraint. But as I mentioned, if you make the splitting larger than 3 to 4 MeV, binding with nitrogen is not possible.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm confused about energy scales. What is the scale of masses of this type of discharge station of some neutral one? I thought it was hundreds of GeV.
Yes. Well, I mean, the calculation of binding energy was in the limit, but it was much, much larger than
that. But then when you look at isotopes, looking at isotopes which differ in their mass by not a few MeV, but 100 GeV.
Yeah. That's the standard probe that people do for charge dark matter. This is the same.
Right, but the standard searches for rare isotopes are not in that.
Oh, yeah, the range is huge. The range can go up to 10 to 7 GeV, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I think they are in charge. Yeah, it sounds very weird to have an isotope of hydrogen that's 10 to the 5 GeV, but according to the constraints,
I do appreciate these inconvenient.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. But what we were actually kind of surprised at is that we couldn't rule it out this way, because most of the constraints are for light elements. I guess because these are the things that are most easy to access, and also quite well mixed in the atmosphere. So if we make the splitting for this electromagnetic capture larger than around 4 MeV, we couldn't find a swimming constraint. There are some tests for anomalous isotopes, things like gold and so on, but they're not actually strong enough to give us a significant. So if I go back here, as far as we can tell, this isn't ruled out, provided we make the binding energy sufficiently large. So again, in the second range, above 4 MeV. So that's kind of interesting. It would be interesting to know whether direct detection experiments could actually see this. I think it's possible, but because the data acquisition is really tuned to looking at nuclear recoil, I don't think anyone's really looked for it. That's direct detection. How am I doing for time? 2 minutes. Okay. Very quick comments on indirect detection. Usual things people think about, annihilation in the galactic center or anywhere else which is over dense. Maybe a quick comment on the 511 kV line. Other things occasionally that are discussed are neutrinos from annihilation, say, in the sun. In this case, this one doesn't work, or at least it doesn't work provided the splitting is small enough that you can have captured by ion. The abundance of ion in the sun is much larger than the natural, but well, the cross-section for captured by ion is much larger than the annihilation cross-section, so all this stuff, if it were there, it would be trapped in bound states with ion, so I won't worry about the third one. Just a quick comment about the first two. So rather than having capture with nuclei, you can have a resonant transition producing mono-energetic gammas. This is, a resonant chi2 plus, chi2 minus bound state. You can straightforwardly estimate what the cross-section would be, right? And again, you have to tune the splitting to make it really interesting. Normally, this monoenergetic flux in SUSY models is well below the usual sort of continuum or, well, there are all sorts of different contributions for gammas, but the monoenergetic lines don't seem to be that large. The flux isn't that large. Here, however, you can make it of order the largest flux in most of these models, provided again it's tuned. So that's interesting. Obviously, monoenergetic lines are the easiest things to see, or at least to distinguish from background. Another interesting quantity that people have looked at, we also looked at it, is this 511 keV line from the central part of the galaxy. It's a very well measured flux, presumably from E plus E minus annihilation, so from the source of positrons. So here, one can imagine a scenario where these things bind to nuclei in the interstellar medium. Now, the abundance of in the interstellar medium is highest for lighter nuclei. So, again, in principle, this is possible. The trouble is that to get the required flux, the cross-section has to be large, and then you run up against these terrestrial bounds on heavy elements, say, combining with nitrogen. So, in fact, it doesn't quite work. Well, the mechanism would work, but it seems to be ruled out by terrestrial constraints. And most recently, in fact, the data is, well, there was always a possibility here that this was purely astrophysics. In fact, that was probably the most likely option. And the most recent data is less, well, it's perhaps easier to explain things now with astrophysics than with physics. But nonetheless, this is still an interesting step. But at least within this model, it could work. All right, so I think my time is up. As I said, I don't think I'm talking about a really exotic model here. It's an exotic part of the parameter space, perhaps, and the signals are rather interesting. But it's worth thinking about if we have sensitivity to it in direct detection experiments. It's interesting to see whether one can actually kill it. As I said, it also has interesting indirect effects, and maybe there are other things we didn't think about that might also be observable.
What mass do you assume for X?
Well, not much actually depends on it, but we're thinking around it.
So you believe that it doesn't depend?
Well, the calculation of the binding energy is within the limit, but the mass
is much
larger.
You assume that mass is much bigger than nuclear mass?
Yes. That's all. Yeah, I mean, we have in mind that it's a bit heavier than normal, for reasons related to the introduction I had at the beginning, that if it's much heavier, you need to find reasons for enhancing the annihilation cross-section. If it's 100 GeV, you would ask, well, why do you need to go with this parameter regime? If it's a TeV, it's more natural.
Did you assume fermionic dark matter here? If so, what would change?
Sorry, that's something I really should have commented on, completely forgot. So in the case where we have a leptonic current, obviously you need one of these guys to be a scalar and the other one to be a fermion, just to make the current work. So in that case, again, I'm not trying to pick a particular model. If you want to think about SUSY, then you can have a neutralino, and then the charge guy is a scalar, selector. But it doesn't have to be like that. But in the case of the electromagnetic current, which is like, just to write it down, I need one to be for the current one, please.
On that last point, did you need delta M to be so small to get a large enough cross-section for 511 keV?
No, it was to do with the fact that the abundance of CNO or lighter elements is much larger than the abundance of the heavier metals in the interstellar medium. So we could have considered binding with heavier guys, and then delta M could have been larger, but then the abundance is getting too small, and so to get the required flux, it becomes more difficult. I must admit, I don't think we looked at it terribly carefully to see whether it's possible, but the abundance does drop quite quickly for heavier metals. So I don't think it would work, because it was already on the real borderline. You still needed a unitarity bound style cross section.
For mass being very small, like you still have them around the temperature of 1 eV in the inner universe, which are aware of. And so, like at some point, you also don't convert them by scatterings.
Well, yeah.
Data more all the way long, so if you have like, this should like give you a lower number.
Well, the assumption here was that there was always some decay channel. So in the electromagnetic case, it's pretty clear that you're going to have a decay channel in the universe where the charge state decays in the, provided that I think the bound, so that it goes before BBN, was the coupling was, you know, no, I don't know, anything above 10 to the minus 10 or 10 to the minus 8 was a slope. It's
so
a relatively weak constraint.
Large phase space, like when you have data m of the order of 1 MeV or 1 TeV particle, don't you get a very large phase space?
No, well, I mean, that was the calculation of the cross section. So provided that coupling, let me go back to this case, I guess it was the most interesting. Right here. So obviously, you compute the cross section, you know, and demand that it decays before BBN, so you want the decay of this guy staying to this guy, and then the bound of the coupling was something like 10 to minus 8. It's not terribly strong. It would be important if you wanted to really think about this in the case of a SUSE model, because then there are more issues to do with the fact that you've got flavor changing interactions as well. So it can be a constraint in a particular model, but as I said, the rough number to get to avoid any problems with that is that the coupling has to be not terribly large.
For given data,
well, this is.
No, I think it's the way around. The coupling cannot be exceedingly small. Otherwise, if it's very, very small, then
It has to be larger than 10 to the minus 8. Too small, and you can run into trouble.
So, do you get any of these charged particles to bind to nuclei by that chemical synthesis and stay around?
Well, this is another project of Maxine's.
I mean, they could be primordial, right?
It's a whole other story. Yes, there is a story related to that. For this story, we just decided to make things simple and demand that it decay. Yes, of course, if it does live longer, it can have very interesting effects. That's what Maxine has discussed.
Okay, so if there are no more questions, then let's thank Alan and all of you.